Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 99 of Dogcast Radio. In this show, we have two different responses to a listener's questions about Cushing's disease. We'll be hearing from veterinarian Nancy Kay.
What Cushing's disease, or also known as Cushing's syndrome, really refers to is an overproduction of cortisone in the body.
And we'll have some advice from animal healer Nikki Senior.
The crystals, I would say, for Cushing's disease, obviously, if the dog is feeling a little bit lethargic, I'd probably go for amber or citrine, which are natural energizers.
We also have the Dogcast Radio news, and I'll be talking about Buddy's birthday. But before all that, we have an interview with Edie Girolam, who's the author of the intriguingly titled Am I Boring My Dog? An amazing collection of dog-related questions. And basically, if there's a question about dogs, it's in the book. Very often, the dog writers I interview have had dogs in their life since childhood, and that amassed knowledge leads to their literary career. But for Edie, things were a little different.
Yeah, you know, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, well, first of all, I lived in a very small apartment or flat, and it was one bedroom. There were four of us, and there wasn't any room for a dog to begin with. And I always like to say my mother feared all creatures, great and small. She was not a fond. She wasn't fond of pets of any kind. We finally convinced her that. To get a hamster, but that was really pushing it, and nobody in my neighborhood had dogs either. It just was just kind of an urban growing up, and dogs just weren't part of our community. So even though I always liked them, and of course, you know, watching TV, I would see Lassie and Rin Tin Tin, and I thought, oh, wouldn't that be fun to have a friend like that? But you know, it just wasn't on for where I was living at the time, so I never thought about the possibility of having a dog when I was growing up.
Yeah. I guess that's good, because, I mean, I briefly had a dog as a child, but I yearned all my childhood years for a dog, desperately, you know. And then my mum got one just as I was 18, and I had four more years at home, and then I left. And I was like, well, that wasn't fair, was it, really? But, you know, I have forgiven.
No.
I've come to terms with it now.
That's right. Well, at least my mother was consistent with the no animals policy.
Yeah.
There was no way she would have gotten any kind of animal when I left home. So
yeah. Oh, that's fair.
Yes, yeah. Much fairer. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so now you have a delightful little dog called Frankie. How did Frankie come into your life?
Well, you know, I went on kind of coveting dogs for years and years after I grew up. But it's like anything else, actually. I think of it like driving, because I grew up in New York City and didn't need a car. And years went by, and I became a little bit phobic about it. I just was afraid to drive after a while. And it was the same thing with getting a dog. I just... You know, because I didn't know that much about it, I was very nervous. And then I write about food and travel as well as, well, this was my first dog book, obviously, because Frankie was my first dog. But I am friendly with a group of restaurant writers in town, and one of them, named Rebecca, was a dog rescuer at the time. And you probably know dog rescuers, and if you say to them, I love dogs, but they can immediately get rid of the but for you. And so I said, but I travel too much. And she said, well, that's okay. I'll watch any dog you get when you go away. And then I said, well, I don't know. So I kind of put it off. And then Rebecca emailed me a picture of this cute little dog, and I said, okay, I'm in. And that was it. That's how I got Frankie.
Wow, that's incredible. That's amazing to see his photo. And I don't think I've never done that, I don't think, and sort of just seen a photo going, yep, okay, that's for me.
Well, it was just a question of finally taking the plunge. Because, you know, we'd been talking about it for so long, and she was really trying to to get me enlisted. And I really was very ambivalent. I truly wanted a dog, but I was just terrified. And, you know, that was the final straw, seeing this cute little face looking up at me from my computer screen. And said, okay, if I'm going to get one, this is the one.
Yeah.
This is the one. Yeah. So there he was.
Mm. I mean, in some ways, it's nice that you took it, you know, that you were aware of what a big commitment it is. It's not something to be taken on lightly. It is a life-changing thing to bring a dog into your life.
Well, that's right. Absolutely. And I think it's a good thing that I knew that, but that can be taken too far to the point that I took it where you can miss out on the joys of having a dog in your life.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that's what happened to me for so many years. I was just terrified. I thought, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. You know, and why do I think that it's possible to take on this responsibility? And of course it was possible.
Mm.
You can do it, but it's, as you say, it's better to know that it is a responsibility than to go into it blithely and say, oh, well, you know, no problem. I'll just take this dog.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's worse.
Oh,
overthinking it in a way.
Yeah, definitely. No, you've got to be aware. Now, obviously, having come to dog owning, you know, a little bit later in life then, that it, you know, it wasn't part of your background earlier on, I think that's given you the edge, particularly for your book, because you ask so many questions in this book. And, you know, I'm sort of reading them going, gosh, I've never thought of that. There's an amazing amount of, you know, a variety of issues in there. And it goes all the way through from choosing a puppy right to the end of that dog's life. It's amazing.
Absolutely. I just, you know, people who grew up with dogs don't necessarily know what they don't know. But if you come to it new as an adult, then there are just so many things that you don't know. And you just come to it as kind of a blank slate. Of course, I read things, but you know, when you read things, it's kind of abstract. And then when the dog actually arrives in your house, and, you know, when Frankie actually arrived in my house, he was very depressed. He lay on the couch and, you know, looked at me like, oh, my God, what have I done to the dog? So, and I felt the same way, and I thought, I'm going to give him back. This isn't working. And then, of course, I thought, no, it's got to work. He's this sweet little dog, and you know there are people far meaner out there who know how to take care of dogs, and I can do this. And so, of course, what I didn't know then was he's just a one person dog. So he had bonded with Rebecca, and now he's completely bonded to me.
Yeah, yeah. Now I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. With, you know, I mean, you say the you know, the emotional roller coaster of those early days, and you know, I do think there's a time, particularly with your first dog, when you sort of have this time when you think, what on earth have I done? You know, and you really mm-hmm. have a crisis, and it is. You know, even with an older dog, you've got adjustments to make, and the dog's got adjustments to make. You know, even if you, without sort of the housebreaking issues of a puppy, but it really is a difficult time.
Oh, and I think you just need to prepare for that. You can't prepare for it totally because you don't know what's going to upset you until you know the dog. But you're going to be upset in some way or another, and so just be prepared to go through a little bit of an emotional turmoil at the time. And if you know that, if you are prepared to the emotional state, then I think it's a lot easier.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't. I didn't know how upsetting it could be. You know, I came in with the idea that, oh, cute dog, I'll feed him and he'll love me.
Mm.
You know, it just doesn't work that way. There's so many complications. It's like, you know, imagine being handed an infant, you know, without having gone through childbirth and without having gone through the preparation of anything, and just there's this strange creature in your house.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot of adjustment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, I love the way as well, because you're very honest, and you know, you've clearly gone through all these things, and you've experienced them and thought about them. And I love the issues that you mentioned around choosing your dog's name.
Oh, yeah. I had this fantasy before I got Frankie that I would have a dog named Stella. If you've ever seen On the Waterfront, I'm sorry, it's that's not On the Waterfront. It's
Streetcar
Named Desire.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm getting my Marlon Brando films confused. So, you know, he yells Stella! And
yeah.
I always wanted to have a dog named Stella so I could yell down the street. And so that gets old pretty quickly. And I'm glad that Frankie came named Frankie, so I didn't have that issue. He's a little Frankie. There's no question about it. It just suits him. Mm-hmm. So those are things to think about, though, what name really suits your dog. And you can change your dog's name if you get a dog from the pound and, well, don't know the original name for one thing. So, but you should get a name that's fairly, think of a name that's fairly short. So when you need to call your dog in an emergency situation, you don't have to say something like Titus. Titus Andronicus is the example I use. You want to have something that's fairly easy to use. But, you know, people always come up with pet names for their dogs. Like,
yep.
He's Frankie Doodle because I thought of Yankee Doodle, and he's Dandy, so he's my Frankie Doodle Dandy. And sometimes when he gets particularly on a, he's very demanding. I call him his Frankiness, and he has these funny little ears that stick out and go around in different directions. So I sometimes call him Bat Boy. People are going to come up with funny names for their dogs anyway, but
yeah.
The one he knows to answer to most is Frankie, when he chooses to answer to.
True.
Yes.
Aww, no, yeah.
He's pretty good at coming to his name.
Yeah, so. good. Now, although you do deal with some, you know, serious issues, there's a lot of humour in the book, and I love the bit where you're considering sort of what breed will suit you best, or a mix, and you sort of talk about a canardly. So can you explain that?
Well, one of the things that is... there aren't many downsides in getting a mixed breed, and but one of the things is that people ask you what kind of dog you have, and one of the things that I always have fun with, I say, oh, well, he's a canardly, and people will say, a canardly, and I say, yes, I can hardly tell. I get a kick out of that, especially when people say, oh, yes, I've heard of that, a canardly.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
Then you
like
just
that.
Sort of stand there with a straight face and nod. But, but you know, there's so many different things you can say. Heinz 57, you know, after the old ketchup varieties. I don't know if you had that.
Yes, yeah.
So you can just have fun with that, because people are always asking about mixed breed dogs. But, you know, there are other advantages, you know, certainly health issues, because mixed breeds don't tend to be as inbred as, you know, all those issues that have been coming up lately about show dogs. It's just horrible. And you know, in general, mixed breed dogs tend to be healthier. Now, that's not a given. Frankie ended up developing diabetes, and it is a genetic condition in dogs, not necessarily in cats. So, you know, there are no guarantees, but in general, they at least don't have the problems that inbreeding causes in purebred dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you address another issue that sort of occurs to me when I'm writing things, because I use the term owner, and I don't kind of mean, you know, I own my dog like a slave and it's my right to, you know, boss him about, you know, I don't mean that, but, you know, I own him, he's mine and I'm his, you know, that's what I mean by it, and you use the word owner, don't you?
Yes, and I don't think it's a problem. You know, I, of course, as a writer, I think language is very important, but I think when it comes to how we treat our animals, actions are much more important.
Yep, yeah.
And so, you know, using a term like guardian isn't going to make anybody care anymore for their animals if they're disposed not to be kind to them. So in the case of owner, it is more accurate, and you know, there are legal issues surrounding that too, and you know, question of dogs as property and all of that. So, you know, in that case, the only time that I think guardian ownership is an issue, is, and I talk about that at the end of the book, when you are trying, if you should die before your dog, which is rare, but it happens, and you need to establish a trust or somebody to take care of your dog. In that case, guardianship is a correct term, but in day-to-day life when you're with your dog, I always say when Frankie starts paying the bills, then we can discuss a more equal relationship. But until then, I own his cute little butt.
Good for you. Yeah. Now, the book is called Am I Boring My Dog? And one of the questions is, am I boring my dog? And I actually like that because it does, you know, flag up for people. This is a big, complicated commitment. It's wonderful and it's joyous, but it's big and complicated. And it's not just about, can I fit a walk round the block with the dog, is it?
Right. Well, it really did start because I saw Frankie yawning at me occasionally, and I thought, well, I guess he doesn't like my conversation, does he? And then I found out as I went on that yawning can be a sign of stress, but it led me to be thinking about what do dogs need to keep them occupied. And, of course, we all hear about different jobs that dogs used to have, specific breeds like sheep herding. And, you know, there are not many dogs who can do their jobs anymore. So one of the things that we need to do to substitute for those jobs is to keep them occupied. And one way is exercise. And different breeds need different amounts of exercise. If you get a Rhodesian Ridgeback, for example, you can spend hours a day. And people don't have that much time to spend. And so you need to research a dog. I mean, some people get dogs because they want to exercise and take long runs, and that's great. They can get breeds that will go along with that. But if you don't have that much time and you aren't able to give them that much exercise, but every dog needs some, but, you know, you can get the smaller breeds, and the lap dogs don't require as much exercise as the big dogs. So you just have to know, anticipate what you can and can't do. But the other thing is that dogs are very social. So it definitely is a question of exercise, to keep them healthy and, from being bored, but they also need to be with people. With other dogs and with people. You know, they pine away if they're left alone all day. So you have to find ways to occupy them. And there are things you can do, for example, toys, those Kong toys that you fill with food, and you can keep them occupied with their meal. And, you know, when you have to leave home, you can get dog walkers to come by and walk them. You know, there are all kinds of things you do, but you just can't leave a dog unexercised and at home all day alone without expecting, you know, some kind of destructive behavior. That's
yeah.
Just, you know, they go a little crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I must admit that we have made a commitment not to leave ours more than 5 hours. You mm-hmm. know, in exceptional circumstances, we'll leave them 6. Now, that we are lucky to be in that position that we can do that, you know, in that I have my timetable is my own, my routine is my own, and I can sort of set that around the dogs. But I do get funny looks from some people when I say, oh, I won't leave them more than 5 hours. And they kind of go, well, they won't need to, you know, they won't need a toilet break that often. And you think, but it's more than that, you know, they will miss me, or I assume they'll miss me.
Well,
I mean,
they give me...
Yeah, yeah. So why should I put my needs and go, oh, I know, they're always there for me, whether I'm in a good mood, bad mood, ill, well, you know, but I'm suddenly going to turn around and go, oh, you know, you can amuse yourself for 10 hours, I'm off. You know,
right.
it's not on.
No. No, I mean, you know, in some cases they might have each other for company and do fine, but, you know, they do kind of pine away for you, and it's not just because they want food. I was just interviewing Dr. Nicholas Dodman for an article I'm doing for Your Dog Magazine, the newsletter for the Cummings Veterinary School at Tufts University, and he was saying that dogs really do miss members of their family. It's not just that they're waiting for you to feed them. They consider you part of the family, and You know, some dogs, well, I think he said 15 to 17% of dogs have separation anxiety. Mm. And that's quite a large percentage. And
it is, isn't
it's
it?
Based on, you know, people. And it's not just that they're thinking of where their next meal is coming from.
No.
They just miss you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you saying Frankie's sort of a one-person dog. My dog is a Labrador, and he just loves everybody, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he does single me out in some ways, but I know he loves everybody. He, you know, that's his nature. Whereas my daughter's dog is a Bichon Frise, and they are both sort of family dogs, and they both knock around with all of us. But if I take my daughter somewhere and come home alone, Buddy, my Labrador, comes to greet me. Now, the Bichon will run past me and want to look where Jenny is, my daughter is. And only when she's established that Jenny isn't coming, then she'll come and have some fuss from me. But she wants her mom before she wants me, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, but that is how some dogs are. And so you know that it's not just arbitrary, you know,
yeah.
Not just the people who feed you. It's that person that they form a bond with. And that, I think, is what we love so much about dogs, because we are important to them.
Yeah, yeah. They really want to interact with you, and they need to. And mm-hmm. and they, you know, I always say, if it looks like love and it feels like love, I'm going to call it love.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, another area that I don't think we've really covered in the 4 years that Dogcast has been going. I don't think I've ever sort of talked to somebody about this, but you've got a whole area about better dog homes and gardens, you know, for them and us. And as I say, this is actually crucial, but I've never covered it before. So what advice have you got for people?
Well, it depends on, I mean, as you say, it's an entire chapter devoted to it. So, well, first of all, you have to establish your own comfort level. You know, some people don't mind a little messiness and a little bit dog hair around. Some people really mind it. So there's, first of all, the human comfort level, and there are many ways to get around that. First of all, rugs are not a good idea. If you can get a tile floor, that's always better than, and, you know, with area rugs that can be cleaned more easily, that's always good. Slip covers, you know, things that you have put on your over your couch that you can easily just zip off and throw into the wash. That's one way of dealing with it. People have to take that into consideration. You get these cute Siberian husky puppies, or, you know, dogs that are going to grow up into big hairy dogs, and so you have to think about what you're going to encounter, and if that's going to bother you, then you need to get a breed that doesn't shed as much, like poodles.
Yeah,
I was just lucky that Frankie doesn't shed. I didn't know. He probably has some poodle in him, but other people, you know, get these dogs. So as with anything else, you need to know. But you also, there are ways of getting around that. If you keep your dog well brushed, at least a lot of the hair can go into the brush. As opposed to, you know, spreading all around your house and that kind of thing. So there are those tricks. And then, you know, that those questions have two parts. One is taking care of yourself and your own cleanliness needs and coping with that. And then there's the part of taking care of your dog's health, because a lot of people inadvertently use dangerous chemicals. So luckily, you know, when it comes to cleaning, luckily there's so many green products around that are healthy for pets that it's not difficult to find them. But you have to be aware that there are a lot of products that are toxic, and, you know, that your dog, I mean, imagine an infant crawling on the floor and occasionally licking it.
Yeah.
And dogs breathe more quickly than children, so they inhale more toxic substances. So you have to be careful about that aspect of it too. So between cleanliness and taking care of the health, those are the two main concerns inside the house.
Yeah. And what about gardens? Because obviously dogs love, you know, gardens and exploring them. So what about there?
Well, some people, again, this is a question of knowing breeds to a certain degree. Some people get breeds that love to dig, and it drives them crazy. And first of all, just, you know, live with that. That's what the dog does, and it's not personal. But mm-hmm. there are ways of getting around it, and one way that I read about that I thought was really great is give your dog a little patch of the garden to dig in, and you establish that territory and train your dog to dig there, and you just keep, you know, you start off by hiding little things that your dog would love to dig for there, and it gets to be a routine where your dog gets to dig, but just in a certain part of the garden, so you get to keep the rest of your garden nice, and you have a happy dog digging away in his little part of the garden.
Yeah, that's really good. Could you train him to sort of grow vegetables, do you think? Or are we pushing it there?
I think we're pushing it. There's that opposable thumbs issue that they have a problem with the trowel.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. I mean, my lab doesn't dig, but my Bichon does dig, and she will come in, and her face will be black with soil. And you sort of look right. And you go, "What have you been doing?" And she looks at you like, "Nothing." I can see you have.
Well, and the other thing is that there are some plants that are dangerous to dogs. And I don't know if you have a similar thing on the website of the RSPCA, but on the ASPCA, there are lists of plants that are toxic to dogs. There are things like oleanders, which I didn't know about, that grew in my backyard, that are very dangerous to dogs. Them and things like ivy, which seems counterintuitive, but they can be very unhealthy. So that's one thing you need to check what you're growing in your garden too. Again, it's the other side of the coin: how to keep your garden nice and how to keep your dog safe in it.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I mean, people can buy the book and read the whole section and you know, learn everything that you've found out about it. And you know, I mean, it's fascinating, but it's quite worrying, as you say, when you think, gosh, I didn't know that was dangerous for dogs. And there's a whole range of things, you know.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I do, and you know, because I obviously can't cover everything, is direct people to good websites for it, because you know, I have a lot of information in the book, but a lot of the information I put in the book is where to find more information, because there are people who know far more than I do, for example, about toxic plants, and that's what websites are for. Where they can be very specific about which plants, and you know, of course, they're coming up with something new every day, and you can drive yourself crazy when you think about what foods are dangerous and what plants, and you go, oh my god, what have I done? I've got this creature that can't eat anything, and I have to watch my household cleaning. But it's, you know, it becomes routine. You just have to be aware of certain things.
Yeah.
And, you know, like with little kids, you put things in a place that they can't find them. You don't want your medication to somehow get into your dog. So, and they're curious. They choose things.
Yeah.
So.
Now, you know, as you say, you can drive yourself mad, and you can consider sort of things from every angle. And you do address some delicate areas. And the one which sort of amused me was, am I using my dog as a substitute for my kids who left for college?
Right.
So how do you deal with that one?
I don't think that's a terrible thing. You know, people can be terribly judgmental. And I think, what is wrong with loving another creature so it's not human? So, as I say, you know, dogs are often much nicer. They never question what you're wearing. They never say that suggest that you're embarrassing them. You know, they're quite nice to have around to have discussions with. You can tell them all your problems, and they're not going to roll their eyes at you. So
yeah.
I say, go for it.
Absolutely.
You know, why not substitute them? And, you know, it might be, I use the example of, you know, suggesting that your dog might get more attention in your will. And that might get your kids to treat you a bit nicer if they think their inheritance is going to the dogs, literally.
I like it. You know, I think there's some crafty advice in here. I like that. Now, obviously, you know, as I say, there's such a range of questions, and some of them, as you say, are inspired by sort of your own and Frankie's experience. Was there anything else that inspired you?
Well, it was just outside reading. You know, once I did get Frankie, I just started reading about dogs, looking at other dogs, and, you know, it was more a question of just finding the whole topic fascinating. Again, when Frankie was diagnosed with diabetes, I had been primarily a travel writer, and so I ended up not being able to travel as much, and so I started, researching the disease, and then I started writing for the newsletter that I mentioned for Tufts University, and researching other aspects of, you know, living with dogs, basically, and it became an interesting topic in its own right. So that kind of developed from there, but it definitely all stemmed from Frankie and from having this living creature with you that you really wanted to understand.
Yeah, and it gets fascinating. You know, the more you find out, I find, the more I realize that I don't know, and then I want to go and find that out.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and it leads to all kinds of interesting directions.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant. I mean, where can people find out more about you, Edie?
Well, I have a blog called WillMyDogHateMe.com, and it's actually kind of funny. That was an alternative title to the book. That's, people always ask me, why do you say that? Why do you call your blog that? And as I say, it's, dogs don't hate you, but people are always feeling guilty. Am I boring my dog? Will my dog hate me? They're so concerned with what their dogs will think. Well, dogs really aren't that judgmental, and they don't hate you. They can get upset, you know, and aggressive, but they don't have that hate emotion. So anyway, that's why my blog is called Will My Dog Hate Me? And I also have a website, ediegirolam.com. And of course, you can buy the book on Amazon.
We have the links Edie mentioned, as well as how to contact her on Twitter and Facebook on the Dogcast Radio site. If you know someone just discovering the wonderful world of dogs who's full of questions, or if you want to show someone they don't know everything about dogs, then Am I Boring My Dog could be the perfect book for you. I certainly enjoyed it. An American Animal Hospital Association poll showed that 33% of dog owners talk to their dog on the phone or leave messages on an answering machine while they're away. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. Here at the Dogcast Radio News Desk, we love a story that emphasises just how good our dogs are for our health. We've reported on studies showing how they lower blood pressure and stress and improve recovery time. But now, new research indicates that stroking a dog can halve the amount of painkillers patients need. The researchers at Loyola University of Chicago suggest that their findings justify the use of pet therapy in hospitals and even recommend its expansion. They point out that patients recovering from joint replacement operations were able to halve their pain medication. So, next time you have a headache, instead of popping a pill, try fussing Fido instead.
And now to a woman who had a major headache when she found herself stranded in her yacht, caught in a storm off the Turkish coast. Laura Hughes had no choice but to abandon ship. But the problem was, she had a litter of puppies on board to get to safety as well as herself. Laura, her friend John Cochrane, her two dogs and their nine puppies were all on board when the boat broke down in the storm, leaving them stuck around 100 yards from the shore in a rough sea. The adult humans and canines could swim the distance, but what about the pups? Laura found the solution. She put the pups into a milk crate and balanced the crate on her head while she swam. Thankfully, the whole party made it safely to dry land, and Laura is now looking for homes for the puppies.
So do you think any of them will be called lucky? Well, another lucky dog was in the news recently in Wales in the UK. 4-year-old Cocker Spaniel Nell disappeared while out on a walk one Sunday morning. It was not until the following Tuesday that she was located, having fallen 80 feet down an old disused mine shaft. Somehow the barbed wire at the top of the shaft and the long fall had not injured her. and despite the odd bruise, she was soon back at home and just as happy as a Cocker Spaniel usually is.
Dogs are used to sniff out all manner of things these days, not just drugs. We've brought you stories of dogs detecting mobile phones, turtles in the sea, cancer, and of course alerting to various human illnesses. But in Canada, they are now being used to scent bed bugs. These nasty little bugs are on the rise, spread and fed by the increased amount of travelling we get up to. They are only about an eighth of an inch, but they bite and suck blood from anyone sleeping in an infested bed. Maybe the dogs can sympathise with that from their experience with the odd flea encounter, but they are certainly better at finding the insects than humans are. So let's hope they get to work and get rid of the lot of them.
We finish today with worrying news from an Australian researcher, Dr. Pauline Bennett, and her team from Monash University. She says that just like human relationships, the relationship between a dog and a person can fail. For the dog, this can have disastrous consequences, with them being neglected or even abandoned. The good news is that to help prevent this happening, she is developing a diagnostic tool to help match owners to dogs that will suit them. After studying over 1,000 people, the researchers concluded that the more activities an owner and a dog share, the better care the owner is likely to take of them. They also recommend that to lessen the number of dogs who find themselves abandoned, councils should allow dogs to accompany their owners to more locations, rather than bringing in more and more restrictions.
Well, that sounds good to us. And that's all today from the Dogcast News Desk. Goodbye.
If you were to remove the scent receptors from a dog's nose and lay them out flat, they would cover an area greater than the dog itself. I was contacted by a Dogcast Radio listener about her dog's health problem. Here's Emily to explain the problem herself.
Hi, Julie. Okay, this is Emily Willard, and I'm calling from Winston-Salem, North Carolina in the U.S. And first, I just have to say I absolutely love your show. And I also am following Buddy, your dog, on Twitter. So if anyone out there isn't following Buddy, it's Buddy Dogcast. And it's absolutely one of my favorite tweets to follow. So I recommend that to others. So, okay, on to my question. I'm going to give you some background, but in general, I wanted to ask you a question about my dog, Gracie. And this question is kind of around that. Around Cushing's. Gracie, she's about 12 now, and in April of 2006, she was misdiagnosed with hypothyroid. So the reason we brought her into the vet at that time was she had all these symptoms that were getting worse and worse, so we saw she had a really distended belly, and then she was drinking water like crazy, and her fur started to look kind of frizzed. Her back was swayed. She was chewing absolutely everything throughout the house, more and more. So when she got diagnosed with hypothyroid, we did a thyroid supplement for a while. And then my partner and I took her to another vet, and that was when she was finally diagnosed with Cushing's. So at that point, we began ACTH. We did an ACTH stimulation test, and they had her begin taking lysergine. So next, she did that for a while, and then again, we began to feel a little uncomfortable with her taking a medication and found Peptabs, which is an all-natural supplement that targets Cushing's symptoms, and I think it was from New Vet Labs. So she did that for a while, all the way up till last December, and now we're working with a book that we got about treating Cushing's with diet and herbal supplements. So just context, I mean, my partner and I tend to use holistic and natural remedies for our own health, you know, just making sure that we use diet and exercise and, like, reducing our stress. But we're definitely open to Western and traditional medicine also, and we just want to do whatever is best for our dog, Gracie. So just constantly searching for more information and guidance, and thought you might be able to help.
Okay, we're going to have two responses to this. The first is from veterinarian Nancy Kay.
Cushing's disease, to begin with, it was named after the person who discovered it, a Dr. Cushing's. Mm-hmm. But what Cushing's disease, or also known as Cushing's syndrome, really refers to is an overproduction of cortisone in the body. Now, each dog comes, just like each person comes, with a set of two adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands are responsible for producing a number of hormones, one of which is cortisone. Now, cortisone is the same thing as a steroid. And we're all used to hearing about anabolic steroids, the steroids that build up muscle, you know, the type that athletes take. They're not supposed to, but they do.
Yeah.
Well, cortisone is a catabolic steroid. And so rather than developing muscle, it tends to cause muscle weakness. So muscle weakness is one of the common symptoms of Cushing's disease. The dog can no longer jump up on the couch or is lacking stamina on walks. The reason for the pot-bellied appearance associated with Cushing's disease that Gracie's mom described is because of loss of tone of the abdominal muscles. The same with, you know, if you see a 1 or 2 year old child, how they have that pot belly.
Yeah.
It's because the abdominal muscles are not well developed. The other common symptoms with Cushing's disease are increased thirst, therefore increased urine output. Sometimes dogs will have some urine leakage because the bladder's so full. Increased appetite. A dog that has always been well-behaved is now trying to raid the garbage can because they feel so insanely hungry. And increased panting. So increased thirst, increased appetite, increased panting, and muscle weakness are symptoms, the most common symptoms of Cushing's disease. That being said, not all dogs read the textbook. So some dogs may come in just because they're eating things that they never used to eat, or because they're the person's finding they're having to refill the water bowl much more frequently than they ever used to, or there's now accidents occurring in the house at night.
Yeah.
So, Julie, there's two forms of Cushing's disease. It's a disease that occurs typically in older animals. 85% of dogs with Cushing's disease have what's called the pituitary version of the disease. What that means is there's a benign little growth in the pituitary gland, which is in the brain, that produces a hormone called ACTH, and that hormone tells both adrenal glands to produce more cortisone for the body than the body really needs. And the way that that disease is treated is with medication that instructs those adrenal glands to quit making so much cortisone.
Mm-hmm.
The less common form of Cushing's disease occurs in 15% of dogs with the disease, and that occurs when there's an actual growth within one of the adrenal glands. So when you do abdominal ultrasound, you see that one of the adrenal glands has a growth in it and the other one is very small. It's kind of gone to sleep because the adrenal gland tumor is producing so much cortisone. The more common type, the pituitary version of the disease, both adrenal glands are symmetrically enlarged. So that's a really good way to differentiate. Do you have the more common type that we call the pituitary version of the disease, or the less common type that we call the adrenal version of the disease? The pituitary version of the disease, as I mentioned, we treat with medication. The adrenal form of the disease, we tend to prefer, if possible, to treat by surgically removing the affected adrenal gland.
Yeah.
Are you with me so far?
Yeah. And if you do remove the affected gland, does the other gland sort of wake up and start working?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Got it. So when it comes to treating the pituitary version of the disease, from a Western medicine point of view, there's two medications that work very well. One is called lisinopril, which is the drug that Gracie was on. And then, for whatever reasons, I'm not altogether clear about, that therapy was abandoned. Or there's a drug called trilastine. Now, trilastine has been available and approved for use in dogs in your neck of the woods for many years. It only received approval for use in dogs in the United States within the last year or two. And both drugs are very effective. The thing that one has to always be careful about is some dogs are more sensitive to the drugs than others. And the problem is if you take away all the cortisone, then what you run into is a situation called Addison's disease, which is too little cortisone. And that can make a dog sick. So there is monitoring that's required. When you use trilastine or you use lisinopril, treatment is lifelong. And when well-regulated, the quality of life should be excellent. And there should be restoration of normal hair coat, and alleviation of the increased thirst and appetite, panting, return of normal muscle strength. Really, the quality of life should be excellent. with the well-regulated cushionoid when they're being treated appropriately. I wish this wasn't the case, but I know of no herbal remedies or acupuncture. There aren't any alternative or complementary treatment modalities that tend to effectively treat Cushing's disease. There are alternative modalities, complementary modalities, that mitigate some of the symptoms of Cushing's disease, but they don't really lower the cortisol values in the bloodstream.
Yeah, yeah. So it is something that you're going to need, something prescribed from your vet, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's the dilemma that we have is that the treatments are not without potential side effects. Dogs that are receiving medication for Cushing's disease need to be monitored carefully, especially in the beginning, to avoid turning the adrenal glands off too much. So it's not something you say, here, give your dog this medication to see in a month. If I start a dog on trilastine or lisodrin, I'm going to be talking with that client every 48 hours until we have things well regulated to make sure that there's no change for the worse. I would never want to use these drugs with clients who are not really good observers of their dog's behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And so let's say I had a really elderly dog that had a lot of other problems, and I would be concerned about treating the Cushing's disease, that we could get into trouble with that. That might be a situation where we would just want to palliate or mitigate the symptoms rather than treat the Cushing's disease full bore. What I don't understand with Gracie's story is if things were going swimmingly with the lisodrin, why they stopped that. Because none of the herbal, I think that you mentioned that Gracie was going to be started on some herbal medication.
Yeah, yes, it says pet tabs, which is a natural supplement.
Yeah, and so I'm not at all surprised that the Cushing's disease reappeared and the symptoms probably over the course of months probably recurred.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, from the sound of it, obviously, if you've got the pituitary form of the disease, you know, the dog is going to have some nasty symptoms that they're going to be hard to live with. If you've got the adrenal form where you've got the tumour in the gland, presumably if that's left untreated, that can spread and then you've got other problems, haven't you?
Well, approximately half of those adrenal tumours are benign. And half of them are not. And so you're right. There's a possibility that that could spread.
Yeah.
So each case is highly individualized when it comes to treating Cushing's disease. What your listeners should know is that treating Cushing's disease is something that should be managed by someone who has a lot of experience with it. This isn't something that should be handled by a novice. So it's very reasonable for your listeners to ask their veterinarian how many cases of Cushing's disease they've treated. Whether they choose trilastine or lisodrin is really based on their own personal experience, the same way that you want someone who's putting you under anesthesia to be using the drugs that they're most familiar with and feel most comfortable with. But if I have a dog that has Cushing's disease, especially the pituitary version of the disease, it's not life-threatening, and the symptoms typically come on and progress very gradually. And so if the dog is not experiencing any symptoms that are bothersome to the dog or bothersome to the people who live with the dog, then we don't have to treat it that moment. And I usually will say, come back in 6 months and let's reevaluate.
And the ACTH test.
Yes.
I can't remember. What was the ACTH level?
The ACTH response test is one of the blood tests that's commonly used to diagnose that a dog has Cushing's disease.
Right.
And ACTH is actually the hormone that the pituitary gland is making too much of.
Yeah.
And that ACTH triggers the adrenal glands to produce cortisone and too much cortisone. The ACTH response test involves taking a baseline blood sample, giving an injection of ACTH, and then an hour later, taking another blood sample. And the cortisol values are measured in both of those blood samples. In a dog with Cushing's syndrome, those cortisol values will typically be higher than normal.
Yeah, yeah. So you can...
There are other ways to diagnose Cushing's disease as well. There's a test called a low-dose dexamethasone suppression test. And some veterinarians prefer that test as the first test. Some people prefer an ACTH response test as the first test.
Yeah, yeah. So you can establish whether the dog has Cushing's or not. But
yes.
Then, you know, maybe if it's in very early stages, you might not need to
treat.
But you can, and you probably will get to the point where you need to manage it very carefully in some way.
Yes.
Yeah.
The first step is in diagnosing that the dog has Cushing's disease.
Mm-hmm.
The second step is differentiating, does the dog have the adrenal form of the disease that 15% of them have, or the pituitary version of the disease, which 85% of dogs have,
mm-hmm.
because the treatment recommendations differ for those two types.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the other thing is that if a dog has Cushing's disease, there's a chance that they're leaking too much protein in their urine, and there's a chance that they have high blood pressure. So whenever we have dogs with Cushing's disease, we measure their blood pressure because that may need to be treated if it's high, and we assess for excessive protein in the urine. And those are two abnormalities that really a dog will show no overt symptoms of. So those are two sort of occult things that need to be screened for dogs with Cushing's disease.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose ultimately your advice, well, ultimately, I'll make that more open a question. Ultimately, what would your advice for Gracie, well, for Emily be about for Gracie?
For Emily and Gracie.
Yes.
My advice for Emily and Gracie, as it would be for really all of your listeners, is if you know that your dog has Cushing's disease, try to make sure that the veterinarian you're working with has a lot of experience dealing with Cushing's disease. It's one of those situations where you don't follow a recipe. A recipe is a dangerous thing when treating Cushing's disease. There's a lot of finesse and experience that goes into figuring out what dosage is appropriate for any given individual dog. So the first advice is once you have a diagnosis, work with someone who has a great deal of experience. My second recommendation is that treatment is highly individualized. And for some dogs, treatment, aggressive treatment medically is the right thing to do. For other dogs, just trying to palliate the symptoms is the right thing to do. And it depends a lot on what else is going on for your dog and his functional age, meaning what's the quality of his life been like before the Cushing's symptoms came on. Because that's what you're going to try to get back to, is that baseline quality of life with treatment. I wish for Emily's sake that herbs work, but they really don't at treating the disease.
Well, on Emily's behalf, thank you ever so much for that advice.
My pleasure.
Nancy is the author of Speaking for Spot, a book which will help you become the advocate your dog deserves. And you can hear an interview with her about the book in episode 90 of Dogcast Radio. And you can find out more about her at speakingforspot.com. Since Emily is interested in alternative ways to help Gracie, we also sought advice from Nikki Senior, who's an animal healer, and I'll leave it to her to explain the work she does.
Right, I'm an animal healer, and basically that is working with energy, with animals. It's the laying on of hands, whether it's spiritual healing, Reiki healing, or using a variety of alternative or complementary healing methods which incorporate crystals, flower remedies, and various things like that.
Okay, great. So you've got a variety of treatments that you can call on to...
Yeah, I mean, the main one is the hands-on healing,
yeah.
Which I normally do Reiki because I've been a Reiki master for the last 15 years now. I've worked with animals for the last 30 years, healing them before I was attuned to Reiki. I use spiritual and colour healing as well.
Because we haven't got time today to go into it in too much detail, but I'd love to talk to you another time, because you actually started at about 8 years old, didn't you?
I did, yes. I started with a cat that my dad had rescued from a steelworks in Sheffield, which he used to feed there, and his a couple of friends of his used to feed about 16 to 20 semi-feral cats. However, my dad noticed Timmy, which we later named him, that he was suffering from lethargy. He'd become very lethargic, wasn't eating, so we decided to bring him home. Took him to the vet, who managed to, you know, trap him, take him to the vet. The vet said, well, he's got a tumour, basically, on his renal area. And it would give him about 6 months left to live. I was quite upset at the time. I mean, my parents were very honest with me, and to be honest, I thank them for that, because it led me on to what I do today. I just used to basically sit with him in his basket every day, got home from school, sit with him in his basket, and just visualise white light coming in through the palms of my hands, through the top of my head, and being channelled into the to Timmy, into the cat. Now, my parents, my dad's Catholic, my mum's more open to, you know, complementary methods, but they didn't know what I was doing, and I've been asked hundreds of times, how did you know to do that? Well, the answer is, I didn't. I don't know where it came from. I'd not seen it on TV. I'd never read about it in a book. I mean, I was only 8 at the time, but I just believed that somewhere along the line that energy could affect a change and have a stabilising and balancing effect, and it worked, because Timmy lived for about another 9 years. The vets were amazed at that.
I bet. Incredible. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, another time, I'd love to sort of go into it in more detail with you, but for today, we've had a question from Emily about her dog, Gracie, who is 12 now. She was misdiagnosed with hypothyroid. With various symptoms. Then she had, they did a thyroid supplement and then took her to another vet where they finally diagnosed the Cushing's disease. She was put on Lysadrin. That it sounds like sort of all of last year, all of 2008. Then she's found a natural supplement. That's it.
Okay.
And so she's very interested in she's taken the dog off the Lysadrin, and she's just treating it sort of with natural the herbs, and she has a book on diet and herbs. So really, she's quite interested in how Western medicine and sort of the more complementary and alternative treatments can go hand in hand, if they can, and she just wants to do the best for her dog. So what would your advice be?
I mean, regarding herbs, I'm not a herbalist, so I couldn't really comment on that. Even though I do self-medicate with herbs, I wouldn't like to give advice to anybody else. I would definitely try hands-on healing in the area where the lump or the tumour or Cushing's is more prevalent. Generally, Cushing's disease does manifest in a lot of symptoms like hair loss, skin allergies, frequent urination. So wherever she was seeing changes in the dog, I would suggest that she did actually try hands-on healing in those areas. There's also a few other things that she could use if she's looked into crystal healing as well. I mean, crystals are absolutely fantastic. I've been using them for about 15 years now. Each crystal carries a different vibration, and because they're part of the earth as well, they have a fantastic stimulating and balancing effect upon the human body. The crystals, I would say, for Cushing's disease, obviously, if the dog is feeling a little bit lethargic, I'd probably go for amber or citrine, which are natural energizers, and she could obviously place one of those in the dog's basket, or massage the dog up and down the spinal area around the stomach as well. Hematite, that's another one. I'm actually wearing a hematite ring as I speak. That's fantastic for balancing blood levels, which we know that, you know, Cushing's disease starts that way. Bloodstone, that's another one off the top of my head. That's a lovely green crystal with a red vein running through it. That's actually fantastic for strengthening the spleen, the bones, aids vitality again. So she could actually as well make crystal waters or crystal elixirs with any one of those crystals.
Smashing. Yeah, that sounds great. And you were saying you have worked with a dog with Cushing's disease.
I've worked with a dog with Cushing's disease. It was a Cocker Spaniel, and she's still going after 3 years. I don't see her anymore because she actually moved to the southwest, and that's out of my area. But she is actually still having distant healing every Friday, which I do free of charge for her. So yeah, she's still going very strong despite having quite a pot belly. People think that she's very overfed, but she isn't. You know, the hormones are all over the place, but she's still doing fantastic. I think it's just over 3 years actually now. Mm. About 3 years and 3 months.
Yeah.
So yeah but yeah, she's still going strong. She's doing fantastic.
Yeah, excellent. So there's the sort of the laying on of hands, and there's the crystals.
Laying on of hands and crystals. They're absolutely fantastic. So any, it's just a balancing, really. It's balancing energy field, because if you think about it, every living person, every animal on the planet has an energy. They emit their own energy, and sometimes that's just imbalance in certain areas of the body, whether it be human or animal, and for a variety of reasons, whether it be environmental or for health reasons. It's just a matter of stabilizing that energy, and through healing you can actually that helps towards stabilizing that energy.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you think would help? Or is that...
Yeah, I mean, I also, as well, I think with Cushing's disease, I would look into homeopathy. Again, I'm not a qualified homeopath, but I have had various people come along and say, well, I'm trying that as well as the healing, and that's fine. So I would look into homeopathy. Again, bark flower remedies or batch flower remedies, however you pronounce it. They're suitable for a variety of symptoms. There isn't one that you could go out and buy, say, for Cushing's disease, but for the lethargy, or for the, you know, hair loss or skin allergies or nervousness, like frequent urination, things like that, you could actually buy bark flower remedies as well, which may go a long way in helping these symptoms.
Yeah. So there is, you know, Emily's got a lot of options that she can turn to then.
A lot of options, yeah, and there's many more than I've just mentioned, but I know that we're quite limited for time, but I would say the main options that she could look into and try, and it's just worth a go. And because I've been doing healing for so many years now, I've seen how things can be turned around quite quickly as well. Generally, I think the rule of thumb is to give more complementary methods in relation to herbalism or homeopathy about 3 to 6 months. But I've seen changes within 2 to 3 weeks, you know, whether it's been healing, whether it's been using the crystals or homeopathy, flower remedies or whatever. So you can get quick results as well.
Yeah. As you say, we've sort of touched on it today. We just sort of, you know, because we can't do it sort of in very in-depth. But where can people find out more about you and about this sort of area?
Well, if they go to my website, it's www.ukanimalhealer.co.uk. If anybody wants me to send them distant healing, either themselves or the pet, I do that free of charge as well, every Friday between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. So I just need a photograph to link into the animal, and I would send distant healing, and that's free of charge. But all the information is on my website anyway.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you ever so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
We have a link to Nancy and Nikki's websites, and I hope that's been helpful to Emily and Gracie and to anyone with a dog diagnosed with Cushing's disease. And if you have a dog-related problem you'd like expert advice for, could be health, training, behaviour, whatever, we'd love to find the advice you need. The most successful mountain rescue dog ever was a St Bernard named Barry, who lived during the early 1800s and saved 40 lives. Buddy's birthday is the 11th of December, and this year he turned 7. No one who meets him can believe he's 7, as he is in good shape, and the passing of the years has not diminished his enthusiasm at all. The life expectancy of a Labrador Retriever is given as anything between 9 and 15 years, so at 7, he is definitely at least in middle age. Thankfully, he has no idea of his stage in life, and his behaviour is usually decidedly on the puppyish side. My dog constantly impresses me. When other dogs bark or snarl at him, he never snaps back. Apparently, he has excellent social skills and displays submissive behaviour and avoids eye contact and generally appeases the other dog so that the situation is diffused. Every human gets a thorough greeting, but it's carefully tailored to meet the needs of the individual. Adults, particularly men, get a bouncy, boisterous hello, while for children, he meekly lies on his back and waits for a tummy tickle. He loves all dogs. He certainly loves all people, and he's shown tolerance and kindness to Star, the kittens, and the multitude of other creatures who've invaded his home over the years. Of course, I am fully aware that I can take no significant credit for any of this, nor can I for his so far mercifully good health. I chose a breeder very carefully, I gave Buddy every opportunity to socialise, and I've spent quite a lot of time training him. But most of his good qualities are innate. I have only helped along what nature supplied. I have to own up here that he does, of course, have faults. His greetings can be so enthusiastic that they sometimes tip over into, well, let's call it harassment. He can become very insistent about gaining your attention, leaning against your legs and constantly nudging your hand or arm. Also, and I'm only mentioning this because I feel I've built up a relationship with you over the months, so new listeners, please don't judge me too harshly, as I'd hate to make a bad first impression. But despite a considerable amount of work on his recall, if Buddy really decides he wants to meet a particular dog or person, he goes into selectively deaf mode and ignores me completely. It doesn't happen often these days, thanks to training, but just occasionally he has a relapse. So why am I being so candid with you? To show you that I know he has some faults, and I suspect he probably has other faults. But I think we all look at our own dog through love-tinted spectacles. How many times have you heard a fellow dog owner defend their dog with phrases like, "He's not fat, it's all muscle, honestly." Or, "I know he growls and grumbles, but it's only because the other dog is on a leash." Or maybe even, "I know it's a little naughty of him to have ripped the couch apart, but it was really my fault for leaving it there in the middle of the room." You see, there's nothing we can't find an excuse for in a dog we truly love. After interviewing, talking to, and just watching so many dog owners over the years, I know we all do it, so I know I must do it too. But to me, Buddy is the best dog in the world. Star comes a close second, but she's Jenny's best dog in the world, and Buddy is her close second. That's how it works, and that's how I think it should work. We should love our dogs, and we should regard them as the best dog in the world. Not to the point of being blinded to their problems, because we need to be able to train them out of them, or at least manage their behaviour. But their faults shouldn't stop us appreciating them. Without getting depressing about it, Buddy's milestone has reminded me that I need to make the most of him, because our time together may already be halfway through, and yet it's gone in such a flash. It only seems like yesterday that he was a naughty puppy digging in the garden, then coming in and getting on the sofa, still covered in mud before I could wipe him down with a towel. Oh, no, hang on, that was yesterday. Oh, well, I can throw the sofa covers through the washing machine, but I can't find another best friend quite like Buddy. He may not be perfect, but he's just right for me. So happy birthday, Buddy. And may you have many more birthdays, but always stay a pup at heart. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315 849 2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 441 288 0922.
you can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
Where do Eskimos train their dogs? In a mushroom.